My name is Ann Peckham. I'm a volunteer with the University of Wisconsin Oral History Department. And with me today, which is January 11th, 2010, is Coretta Thomas, who was the department administrator in obstetrics and gynecology for many years. And she is now Mrs. Sweeney. And I'm very glad to have her. She's the first department administrator that we are talking with. So, Coretta, welcome, and thank you. And if you'll start out by telling a little bit about your background, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I will. During my senior year in high school, we moved from Madison, where I went to school at East High School, to Middleton, and I had to go to the Middleton High. And I was taking a college course in high school, expecting to be a dietitian when I went on to school. And so the last year I had an open hour, so I decided to throw in typing. So I took typing my last year in high school. And as it turned out, I didn't go on to college. I got married in the fall after I graduated, and so I went immediately into a classified secretarial job at the university at the State Lab of Hygiene the Monday after I graduated from high school. And all I had for a background was my typing. I worked at State Lab of Hygiene for about four years. And then I transferred to the Department of Preventive Medicine under Dr. Al Evans, and that was in the same department. And at the time, Dr. Evans was director of the state lab and also chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine. And I worked for him for 6 years. And then he decided to go on to the World Health Organization. And I wasn't real pleased with the people that were coming up behind him in my job, so I decided to look for another position. And at the time, Dr. Ben Peckham in OBGYN was looking for a secretary. And they were friends, Dr. Evans and Dr. Peckham, and he recommended that I go try out for this job. So I did. I went to visit with Dr. Peckham, and I was scared to death of him. I was only 28 years old, and I was a little on the shy side. And after the interview, I went back and told one of my coworkers that I didn't think I would be happy in that department, and I was a little afraid of Dr. Peckham, and so I decided I was going to turn down the job. So his secretary called me, and I told her that I wasn't interested. And a few hours later, I got a call from Dr. Peckham, and he said, "I've been interviewing for several weeks, and I haven't found anyone I want, and I want you to take this job, and I expect you to be here on Monday." And I didn't have enough nerve to tell him no, so I went. As it turned out, it was the best thing I ever did. At that time, I was considered the department secretary, and I had a classified title. I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was secretarial stenographer, something like that, which was a stupid title because I didn't know how to take shorthand. All I knew how to do was type. And the department was very small, Dr. Peckham, and I think there were only four other full-time faculty. And we had just a small handful of secretaries, probably five, I think. This was in 1966. And we were located in the old SMI. Our department office was just down the hall from Dr. Peckham's research labs. And there was one other woman in the office, and we did mostly secretarial duties. The other woman did most of the typing, and I worked on things like grant applications and budget control. And back in those days, the private practice plan hadn't been developed yet, and so we actually did the billing on an old system where we had a hard covered notebook, and we put a piece of paper over the notebook, and we wrote by hand the charge and the description of the service, and then we sent out the bills, and that's how we did it at that time. And the doctors didn't get all that money. They had to submit a report to the hospital or to the medical school, and some of the money went to the dean's office, and some of it eventually filtered down to the private practice doctors. And it changed significantly over the years, but that's how we started out doing it. And it took not that long, because they weren't seeing that many patients, as a matter of fact. Our floor was 3 West, and that's where they did the gynecology surgery, and the OB was done on 3B. And we didn't do that many obstetric procedures. And eventually, later on, during down the line, most of it was all changed over to Madison General, which is now Meritor. I was a classified title, so that meant that everybody else that had administrators at that time mostly were the big departments, and they were also academic staff. And there was a significant difference in that, and we were bound by different rules and regulations, and we had tenure through our classified service where the academic staff had contracts and were reappointed over periods of time and didn't have the same kind of tenure that the classified staff had. Eventually, I had been there for a couple of years, and we decided that we would put my job up for reclassification. And a man came over from a personnel office to interview me, and he ended up meeting with Dr. Packham and told Dr. Packham that he didn't think that the job deserved reclassification, and besides, I made enough money for a woman as it was. Dr. Packham was furious about that. And that was one of the reasons why he felt that he needed to supplement my salary somewhat. But it was a little dicey, because being classified personnel, we weren't allowed to pay them over and above the money that we got for our title. So we started out by having me do quite a few of the practice plan duties on overtime, and I had to keep track of my hours, and then that way the practice plan was allowed to pay me some money for the extra hours that I worked. That didn't... It was hard to break the duties up between medical school and practice plan, and a lot of them had overlap, and so that was difficult, trying to figure out what I could do in overtime. And most of the time, I just put in extra hours and I did what I needed to do during the day or during the evening, depending on what the workload was, not on what type of duty it was.
Greta, do you remember what year the practice plan went into effect?
Well, that's a problem, because I don't have access to any of the files, and I don't remember exactly, except for I do remember that in about 1973 or 74, I got my first what we called incentive payment. I was getting, as I said, every payday, I was getting a little extra money from the practice plan for the extra hours. But at year end, and I can't remember if it was 73 or 74, I got a $5,000 payment for what we called incentive. And I was so thrilled, because that was the first time that I had ever received anything like that. And I was pretty disappointed, because I had recently been divorced, and I was so excited about this money, and I couldn't tell anybody, and I didn't have a husband to go home and say, look at what I've got here. And it was a pretty exciting time. Then within the next couple of years, we picked a few of our most important secretarial personnel, and we started giving them smaller amounts of incentive. And it all turned out that we were doing that illegally, and we had to stop doing it. We had gotten, several of the other departments too were in the same boat, and they'd gotten into trouble with the classified service people, because we were supplementing these salaries and we weren't supposed to. And so at that time, the practice plan was formed as the clinical practice plan, or the consultation practice plan, I think is what it was called originally. But it wasn't it wasn't as centralized as it ended up being, and some of the departments went on to form affiliated university physicians for billing service. But we were a small department, and we weren't part of that for a number of years. But it became obvious that we could, people started looking into what we were doing and seeing that we were spending more and more time doing practice plan duties rather than all departmental duties. And so we had to figure out a way to change that. And so in the meantime, many of the other departments had administrators who were academic staff, and you had to have a bachelor's degree to be an academic staff person. And myself and two other secretaries, Department of Medicine, Mary Risberg, and the Department of Anesthesiology, Mary Gillum, and I were the three departments who had administrators who were not academic staff. And so we worked many hours with the personnel department, and we finally were grandfathered in and got an academic staff appointment. And that made it possible for us to have our salary supplemented and to receive incentive without running into problems with personnel. At one time, let me go back a bit. Dr. Peckham was head of the CPP at that time. And I think he was quite concerned about my situation, my salary. I was a divorced woman with a couple of children, and he wanted to be able to help me. And so he was very instrumental in getting through the practice plan, the ability to pay us on a monthly supplement to our university salary. And also, then at year end, we were getting incentive. Not all the departments were doing this, but it was allowed at that point. And so Dr. Peckham did start giving me an annual supplement, or a week monthly supplement, and then an annual incentive. And at one time, I think I was the second highest paid OBGYN administrator in the country. And I know that because I belong to a group called AMGO, Association of Managers of OBGYN. And we, every year we did, or every 2 years, we did a salary survey. And during this time when I was getting a supplement and an incentive, it became obvious that I was one of the better paid ones in the country, which was really nice for me. We were still not able to supplement some of our other people because they all stayed classified, and so I was the only one in the department getting this. One of the things that, when I first started working in the department, many of the things, not many, but several of the things that we were doing were supplemented by personnel in the medical school. For instance, when we got new personnel, we would send them over to the medical school, and they had a person designated to talk to the employees about fringe benefits. They also had personnel over there that helped with budget control on all of the grants and the monies that we got through the university. Every month we'd get what they call budget control, and we'd have to balance it like you do a checkbook. They also were there to help us, support us in completing our grant applications and getting them walked through the university. And we had several grants at that time. Dr. Peckham was doing research, and we had Dr. Cannon was doing some research. And then Dr. Kloss came to the department a few years later, and he had a big research program. And so we had a lot of research grants going, and they were there to help us write the grants and work on the budgets. And that, all that activity over the years suddenly became the department's responsibility. And so each department was taking care of that on their own. And some of that was good, but some of it was a problem. For instance, in small departments like ours, we didn't do as much as some of the big departments who could afford to hire specialized people to work in those areas. And so I was basically doing all that, counseling people on the fringe benefits and working on the budgets and that was something that I had to do rather than being able to hire someone to do it themselves. And so therefore, I don't think we ever did as good a job as we probably should have, because I wasn't specialized enough in it to understand all the ins and outs, and I always thought that was kind of a negative for the employees. As the time went on, we became more involved in practice plan activities, and as the department grew, we of course added more secretaries, and most of the secretaries were designated to specific faculty. The one person that was in our office, in Dr. Peckham's office and mine, Ann Copenhaver, she became the house staff secretary, and she did most everything that involved our house staff. And the other secretaries in the department did mostly secretarial duties for their individual doctors.
About how many doctors were there by this time? Still not very many.
There still weren't that many. And we started having a few more researchers. But in the practice plan, I don't think we had more than about six people for quite a few years. And obviously, as we got more into my tenure, we got more and more faculty. And Dr. Beekler came, and she was in oncology, and Dr. Shapiro and Dr. Sardo, who then came, were out of our practice, out of our residency program. Dr. Beekler was one of the few people in the country that was double boarded in GYN oncology and in radiation therapy, and they all developed bigger programs than what we'd had before, because we just didn't have the personnel to do it. And we got more and more patients, and the billing became more and more of a problem because it took up more time. After the practice plan was formed, they handled the finances a little bit differently than they did originally, and the doctors were able to maintain more of that money than when they were sending a lot of it to the medical school. The departments that were already part of AUP started to try to recruit the other departments, and eventually everybody, except for there were a couple of positions that didn't join, but most everybody joined the AUP, and they started doing the billing centralized. And that was a really good thing, because we were doing it on a department, and I had eventually hired a secretary who did the insurance forms and did the billing. But again, we weren't specialized, and as Medicare became more and more important in our billing, there were more and more regulations, and it was very difficult to keep up with all these rules and regulations, and therefore, I think it was much better when we joined AUP, because they had people who were trained in that area.
That's the Association of University Physicians.
Right, mm-hmm. And we were one of the last departments to join. They were located over across from Camp Randall, and it wasn't a very convenient situation because it wasn't very close to the hospital. Eventually they moved over, they started out in just a small area across the street, and then they moved into this corner across from the stadium, and eventually they got their own building, and they became very important to us because they did all the billing and all the insurance information, which was a big part of it. And they did a much better job than we did, actually. We then had our own person that came from AUP, was hired by her and paid by her, but she was designated to our department to work just with our physicians and do our billing. And eventually that got to be two people. And so as the years progressed, we kept getting bigger and bigger. In the meantime, I think it was sometime around 1975, we started negotiations to move the OB. Does that sound like the right date?
Yes.
Move the OB over to what was then Madison General Hospital. And there were a lot of meetings. There was a lot of politicking. There was a lot of politics involved with the intensive care nursery at St. Mary's, and Madison General was then going to have theirs, and it was a lot of conflict, and Dr. Peckham persevered and got what he wanted, pretty much, I think, on it, and that was the beginning of one area that I saw as a problem that divided our department considerably, because all the OB people eventually moved over to Madison General, and running a split department is much harder than running one where you're all in the same building, and the OB doctors did come back to the university to see their patients to start out with and to do teaching. Eventually they started having a clinic over at Meritor, so they saw their OB patients at Meritor. And they began to want to be more specialized in perinatal medicine. And we were not doing a whole lot of normal OB. We were working with referrals from around the state. And the reason they closed the 3B unit was because we were doing so few obstetric patients that I think they felt that in order to have an intensive care unit for the nursery and for the high-risk patients, they needed to get more patients, and so that's one of the reasons they moved it to Meritor. As the department continued to grow and we added faculty, of course we added more support staff, and most of the people we hired were to be secretaries for the individual doctors, and usually the girls had one or two, sometimes even three faculty to work for. In the meantime, we also hired someone to do our personnel work, because in the past I had been doing all the personnel work, all the budget control work, all the practice plan work, and it was getting more than I could handle. And I also felt that we needed people that were more specialized in some of those areas to keep up with the rules and regulations. So we finally hired someone that was going to act as our personnel director. And even though I still did the hiring and the firing, she did the supervising of the girls and the day-to-day work assignments and such like that. We continued to add more and more practice plan duties. As AUP was formed, we had, of course, meetings, and all the administrators would meet once or twice a month and start to work out some of the problems with the billing office. We also had departmental meetings where the administrators met to discuss medical school issues. And so we always had that division between medical school and practice plan. Most of the other departments, as I said, had administrators that had academic degrees and, of course, were trained in business. I never was trained in business, and what I learned as I took on more duties. One of the things I wanted to touch on is the kind of administrators the different departments had. I was the person who came up as a secretary and through the ranks, and maybe it was partly because I was female and several of the other department administrators were male, and maybe it was just because that's how I came up through the system, is starting out being a secretary and being a helping hand. I thought there was two distinct levels of handling the titles. The administrators that had business degrees, several of them, it was almost like they were in a contest with their chairman to see who had the most power. We never had that in our department. Dr. Peckham gave me the permission to go ahead and do what I could do, and he stood behind me 100%. I always felt like I was a helping hand to him rather than in contest to see who was going to be running the department. And I also thought that our department, being a smaller department, it probably was better to have a woman who acted more as a helping hand rather than a distinct administrator who had his own office, his own secretarial staff, and or hers, and kind of went their own way. It was it was part of this reason that we would go, we would have the opportunity to travel, to go to meetings. And I observed these same distinctions at the meetings. There were, at the time I first started in AMGO, there was about half and half, half women who came up through the ranks like me and half women and men who had bachelor's or master's degrees in business. And we approached the subject differently. And maybe that's just because I came up that way and thought it was a better way, but I don't think that Dr. Peckham and I had near as many conflicts as some of the other departments had with their administrators. Let's see, what else? Now, let's see, we came to about 1979, we think it was, when we started the new hospital. And prior to moving into the new hospital, we would get deadlines from the medical school to drop everything and, you know, work on our space or work on problems that we saw with our hospital. And Dr. Peckham and I took the philosophy that when those things happened, we would stop everything else and we would do it. And I think in the long run, we were the only department that had enough space when we moved into the hospital because we took the time to plan. And actually, that was about 1979, and I left in 1998. And we were just starting at that time to run out of space and having to think about putting doctors together in offices. Up until that point, we had enough space for our research work that was done on the same floor as our offices. We had a huge conference room on right across from the departmental office, and because we had a lot of continuity in our personnel, there came a time when I was the only one left in the area that knew that the conference room was supposed to be shared with another department, and the other department didn't know it was supposed to be shared, so it became our conference room. And I always thought that was kind of a coup. At the time we moved into the new hospital, I was one of the people that was selected to go out there, learn the facility so that I could run tours. And man, I'm telling you, we were lost all the time in that new place. And it took a long time for those of us that were learning and doing the tours to learn our way around, let alone showing somebody else how to find their way. But we became very, very good at finding our way around, and we loved our new facility. We had nice offices, nice office space. We had plenty of room for the secretaries, and we had a break room, which was nice. And we had some lab space, and our endocrine infertility department was using the research space for their programs. One of the things that we spent a lot of time doing as AUP took over the billing and the insurance work, we still in the departments had to, at year end, get all the billing information and figure out the individual doctors' incentives. And that was a huge job. And it was always done right around the holidays because it had to be paid out by year end. And so we put in many, many hours of overtime. We'd have to send all the information to AUP by a certain date, and they would get it all processed and billed out, and we had to wait to find out what the total billings were and what the total amount of money brought in before we could figure the incentives. And I was still at that point getting an incentive. And so in the department, how we had a practice plan of our own in the department, and in that practice plan it spelled out how the incentives would be distributed, and it was based on monies brought into the department, and it's based on what we call brownie points that was assigned by the department chairman for the activities of the faculty. And it wasn't just practice plan activities, it was activities within the practice plan, how many patients they saw, how much money they billed, it was teaching, it was anything that they did for the department, they could earn brownie points. And this is how the incentives were figured out. Then there was a normally, when we got a final figure of how much money was available, Dr. Peckham would sit down with Dr. Beekler, who was one of the senior members of the department, and they would figure out what my incentive would be. And then when that was taken out of there, we end up with an amount. Then Dr. Beekler and the other division heads would sit down and figure out what the chairman's incentive should be. And when that amount was taken out, then the rest was divvied up by about these points that they earned for their activities in the department and the money that they brought into the department. So it was a pretty big job, and it was time consuming just getting all the people together to meet to make their decisions on what the chairman's incentive should be. It was time consuming. Eventually that was taken over by the we still divvied up the incentive points, but the AUP took over all the last minute stuff that we used to have to spend hours on just before the holidays. So on the last day of the month, we would cut all the checks for the incentive, and it was usually a pretty nice day for everybody. Let me stop.
We're going to run out of tape here.